What to do when you hit rock bottom. Next on The Balanced Word.
Wake up my soul. Wake up early in the day. Wake up my hands and the instrument I play. Wake up my voice. Let the world hear me say, you are worshipped and exalted here today.
It's possible you can look back on your life and identify a time when you hit rock bottom. Maybe it was following the death of a loved one, or an illness that really got you down. Well, that's where we find David as we turn to 1 Samuel chapter 30. Pastor Dave Roth observes something significant in that David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Now that's a way to respond when you hit rock bottom.
Well, we've been going through the book of 1 Samuel, and I've really enjoyed this study. We went through Samuel's story, and for the most part, Saul's story, and then the early years of and middle years of David's story. But we're coming to a conclusion. Next week, Lord willing, we'll finish the book. And the story of David up to this point has been pretty miserable. We saw it last week, where David's history was a history of being rejected over and over again, rejected by his own family, rejected by his king, rejected by his father-in-law, who was the king, rejected by his wife, rejected by people everywhere he went, until he finally found a home with the Philistines. And he thought he belonged, but as we saw in chapter 29 last week, ultimately they lined up all the soldiers to go to war, and the other Philistine rulers said, "What are those Jews doing here? We don't want Jews in our army." And now he is rejected because of his heritage, even though his heritage didn't want him at all. He was so dejected. He argued. He tried to change it, but nope, you know, you guys need to go back home. And so it felt like he had hit rock bottom. He walked for 3 days with his 600 guys to go back to this little city of Ziklag where their families were. And if you thought he had hit bottom, he hadn't, because now in chapter 30, he hits rock bottom. It was bad being rejected, rejected, rejected. In chapter 30, it's worse. So let's dive into this story. Now it happened, verse 1, 1 Samuel chapter 30. When David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, walked for 3 days, it was quiet, nobody's saying anything. Nobody knows what's going to happen next. But the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag, attacking Ziklag and burned it with fire. The Amalekites, who Saul was supposed to destroy them, they keep bouncing back because he spared certain of them and some of their animals and everything. They were still able to come, and you know, they hated Israel because of, you know, what had been done to them. But at the same time, the survivors were doing as much damage as they could possibly do. And they knew the Philistines were heading up north to attack Israel, and they took advantage of it, and they were just rampaging the whole area, and including Ziklag. And so David's hometown, where there was no one left there to protect it, his 600 soldiers were with him. It's basically just the women and children were left, and they burned the city, and in verse 2, had taken captive the women and those who were there, from small to great. They did not kill anyone, which is surprising the way they had been treated, but carried them away and went their way. So the Amalekites took all their stuff and all their people and left. So when David and his men came to the city, there it was, burned with fire, and their wives, their sons, and their daughters had been taken captive, as well as all their stuff. And verse 4, this is where David hits bottom. Then David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. That's it. There's nothing left. There's nothing more. Everything that we've tried has backfired on us. We're off trying to build a future, and these guys come in and they take everything and they destroy our hometown. We thought, well, at least we can go home and recover. They were so devastated that all they could do is cry. Crying's really healthy thing sometimes. It can get excessive, but you know, sometimes the right response to devastation is crying. It does something for us. Children are built to be able to cry naturally. You don't have to teach them to do it. And it has a certain cathartic effect to it when you cry. In our culture, we've always told men they shouldn't cry. And then now we tell women they shouldn't cry either. And so we're denying our humanity in a whole lot of ways. Sometimes it's just a time to cry. Sometimes crying is the most natural and appropriate and even healing response to devastation. And so they just cried themselves out until they couldn't cry anymore. David's two wives, verse 5, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail, the widow of Nabal the Carmelite, had been taken captive. Now David was greatly distressed. He was incredibly under pressure at this point, not only because he had lost his family, but the people were speaking of stoning David because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and his daughters. So David cried until he couldn't cry anymore, and then he realizes, oh shoot, these people are blaming me. By the way, if you're a leader, you'll usually get blamed for whatever happens. And the people who are following you are just saying, well, if you had only done this or if you had done that, either if you did something or if you hadn't done what you did, basically it comes down on you. And so he's lost everything just like they have. Never mind that he has risked his neck to protect them time and time again. Now it's like I'm all cried out and now they're talking about stoning me. It doesn't get lower than that. This is David hitting rock bottom. But look what it says he did. But, in the end of verse 6, but David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Strengthened himself in the Lord his God. I don't know what that means, okay? It means something. It certainly means that where he hadn't in a long time, you don't see records of him seeking the Lord or wanting to hear what God has to say. When he hit bottom, he knew, I need God in a big way. I need to turn back to him. But it's interesting, the choice of words, that he strengthened himself in the Lord. Now, previously, Jonathan had come to him and he said, Jonathan, strengthen David's hand in the Lord. So sometimes another person can come along and lift you up. But what I see from this verse is sometimes there's nobody to do that. Sometimes it's just you. Everyone has turned against you or they don't want to be too close to you. And maybe you've been like that in your life at some point where it's like all the people that I thought would have my back don't. What I'm suffering alone. Nobody understands. No one can help me. Nobody even seems to want to help me. And most people are blaming me for the situation that I'm in. It's in times like that that you have to figure out a way to become strong in the Lord without having the support of other people. Now, God would always want us, ideally, to support each other and to strengthen each other in the Lord. But I would suggest to you that the times when you need the greatest strength from the Lord are going to be times when there isn't anyone else there to do it with you. There are times when after you've cried and you've grieved and you're under attack and you're feeling isolated, that you have to tell yourself, suck it up. You're going to have to deal with this. God is God. God is real. He has been there for you in the past, but you better remind yourself of this because nobody else is really doing it. It's just you right now. And at the times when we feel the most devastated are those times when we feel like nobody really gets it. No one can, well, they might try to say things to help me feel better, but the truth is, if I can't do it myself with the Lord, if I can't find a way where just as a human, that it's just me and God, and I am gonna make this happen because I absolutely need it, that's kind of where David was at that point. Again, I wish it gave us more details about how he strengthened himself in the Lord, but he gave himself a pep talk. He reminded himself of who God is. And then we're gonna see, ultimately, he turned to prayer as well. But it was just him, and he took responsibility for the way that he would deal with this because he didn't have anyone else. And so he strengthened himself in the Lord, his God. And then David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son. Remember, this priest signed up with David when his whole family got killed by Saul because of David. And so now he's hanging with David. He had managed to steal the ephod, the high priest's chest garment that had the Urim and the Thummim in it, which we don't really know how the Urim and Thummim work, but somehow God would use it in order to talk to people at certain times. So he called him and said, "Bring the ephod here to me." And Abiathar brought the ephod to David. So David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them?" And God answered. He strengthened himself in the Lord, and then he pulled it together enough to cry out to God in prayer. And God answered. He goes, "What shall I do now?" David's come a long ways. When he was younger, remember when his guys and he got disrespected by Nabal, they just took off. "We're going to go kill that guy and everybody in his household." And Abigail talked him out of it. Now I'm not going to make a move until I've asked God, and I want to hear from him. It's been a long time since David's done that. And if it's been a long time for you before you really go to God and just ask him what you should do, he's always there waiting. But you're going to have to pull it together enough to do that and be willing to do what he tells you to do. He's not going to give you a multiple choice answer. So he goes, "Shall I pursue him or not?" And God answered, "Pursue." Yeah, chase these guys. "For you shall surely overtake them and without fail recover all." Not only will you catch them and defeat them, you'll get everything back. That let him know, my wives, my kids, they're still alive. Here's a chance for us to recover what has been taken from us, and God's telling me to do this. And so by him crying out to God, that was a good thing. So he went, 600 guys with him. Right away, God told him, and he goes, "Okay, you tell me to do it, I'm doing it now. We are going now." They got to the brook Bezor, and David continued on with 400 men, according to verse 10, for 200 stayed behind, who were so weary that they could not cross the brook Bezor. They'll come into the story later, but you have only 600 soldiers. 200 of them are like, "I just don't think I can get across this stream. I'm completely out of energy and strength and capacities. We just can't do it." Now, David didn't lecture them. He didn't like, "Come on, you're going to do it anyway. Beat them, make them come." At the same time, he didn't hold everyone back. It's like, "We have a mission that we're going to go on. You guys can stay here and watch all of our extra stuff. We'll leave supplies with you, and you can stay here." And so they continued. And then they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David, verse 11. This guy was just laying there dying. And so they gave him bread and he ate. They let him drink water, gave him some Fig Newtons and some ivermectin, two clusters of raisins, which he was really mad because he thought they were chocolate chips and he ate them and they were raisins. But so when he had eaten, his strength came back to him. For he had eaten no bread nor drunk water for 3 days and three nights. He's been laying there dying. They find him. It's amazing that David took the time to minister this guy back to health. Now, it turned out this guy had some information that helped David find where these guys had gone who had captured his family. But he could have just splashed some water in his face and shaken him and said, "Here's a spear at your throat. Tell me what I need to know." But he actually cared enough to nurture the guy back to enough health and strength and care about him, even though he was an Egyptian. And so he does it, and then he said, "Who are you? Who do you work for?" And he said, "I'm a young man from Egypt, servant of an Amalekite. So I was working for the Amalekites as a slave, and my master left me behind because 3 days ago I fell sick." What a difference. David had a third of his army that couldn't continue, and he left them there with food and supplies. It's cool. You guys wait here. Watch the stuff. The Amalekites have a guy who's been faithful, but he's sick. Just leave him without any food or water. But he says, we made an invasion of the southern area of the Cherethites in the territory which belongs to Judah and of the southern area of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. He's like, I was a part of it. You should probably know that. I was the one of the ones who actually, you know, trashed your city, burned it, and helped kidnap your families. And David said to him, can you take me down to this troop? Now, I don't know how he would know exactly where the troop was because he had been laying there 3 days, but he would have some sort of clue as to maybe how to help them find him. And the guy goes, hey, promise me that you're not going to turn me over to my master because he'll kill me. Promise me that you won't kill me. And he goes, sure. And so in verse 16, when he brought him down, there they were, the Amalekites, spread out over all the land, eating and drinking, dancing and partying, because of all the great spoil which they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. These guys were, they thought they had it all. They had pulled it off. They got so much stuff that they just began to celebrate and get drunk and dance and have a party. And by the way, I don't care what you've done that's successful, getting out of control with your partying is a good way to set yourself up, which is exactly what it did for them. So what David did, you know, he saw them partying, so he waited until twilight, and David attacked them from twilight until the evening of the next day. Not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. This is kind of weird. They had 400 camels, so 400 guys got the 400 camels and took off. I mean, if they were fast enough to get to the camels, they were probably 400 of the better soldiers. Now, the Amalekites still haven't been destroyed. Saul was supposed to destroy them. He didn't. This wouldn't destroy them because 400 of them got away. You'll see Amalekites keep coming up and being an enemy of Israel for quite a while. In fact, it's an Amalekite that takes credit for killing Saul ultimately. So 400 get away. They wipe out all the rest. So David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away. Now, they didn't just take it from Ziklag. They took it from all kinds of places. So they got everything. David rescued his two wives, and they were blaming each other. And nothing of theirs was lacking, either small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything which they had taken from them. David recovered all, just like God had promised him that he would. He got everything back. And then David took all the flocks and herds, everything that these guys had driven before them, all their livestock, and he said, I'll take these. This is David's spoil. Now, as they're marching back, celebrating, they're so happy, all their families are there. The 200 guys waiting back at the river, like they were waiting to see their families, and they were hoping this worked out. And so they came, they were so weary they couldn't follow David, but they stayed at the brook Bezor. They went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near the people, he greeted them. Hey guys, we're back. And then in verse 22, there were some just really creeps that worked for David as soldiers. All the wicked and worthless men. Just because somebody's strong enough to go fight doesn't make them worthwhile. Some of them weren't. Of those who went with David answered and said, because they did not go with us, because they wimped out at the brook, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart. Let's just give these guys their wives and kids and tell them to go on their way. We don't have need for them anymore. But David said, my brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us. He goes, no, we're not going to discriminate like that because everything we have came from God. So somebody who's back here watching the stuff is just as much a recipient of God's generosity as those of us whose job was to fight because it wasn't our brilliant strategy, our brilliant fighting. If God hadn't let us meet that Egyptian and then given us the power and we got up early and we went for it, it was all God's. So we're not going to act like it's ours to dole out. He has preserved us, delivered into our hands the troop that came against us. For who will heed you in this matter? You guys are off. But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies. They shall share alike. They deserve to be rewarded who are staying back and working behind the scenes, the same as the frontline soldiers. And so it was in verse 25. From that day forward, he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day, to the day that this was written, that the law is when we go out to war, whatever we take, you know, as a reward for winning the warfare, then the people that are back guarding the stuff, the people who aren't able to go out and fight, they're going to receive just as much as the ones who are fighting on the front lines. And they made that a law.
You're listening to The Balanced Word with our pastor and Bible teacher, Dave Rolfe. And stay with us for more teaching from Pastor Dave. We'll have that for you in just a moment. If you're enjoying this present series called Kingdom Builders, you'll be pleased to hear it's our support offer right now. We'll send you the entire series on a USB flash drive for a gift of $50 or more to The Balanced Word. And please remember, it's your gifts that help us continue the ministry on this station. Just call us right now and request Kingdom Builders. We're here to serve you at 949-362-7475. That's 949-362-7475. You can also make a donation and resource request online at thebalancedword.com. I should also mention you can hear today's program again at thebalancedword.com. Have you had a chance to listen to Pastor Dave's one-minute messages? You can listen to those at thebalancedword.com and even join our mailing list so you can have them delivered to you each day. You can also watch them on Instagram or Facebook by following CC Pacific Hills. Pastor Dave would love for you to join us at Pacific Hills Calvary Chapel. Our service times on Sunday morning are at 8, 9:45, and 11:30. Directions and more information about the church can be found online at ccpacifichills.org. And you can watch our live stream there too, ccpacifichills.org. If we can pray for you in any way, we ask that you contact us through thebalancedword.com or by calling us at 949-362-7475. Now let's return to 1 Samuel chapter 30 for the rest of Pastor Dave's message, When You Hit Rock Bottom.
Now, last part of the chapter, when David, in verse 26, came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, here's a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. And it lists all the different cities of Judah where he said, we're not just going to hang on to all this stuff. We have a lot of stuff. Let's be generous with what God has given us. Because not only does God want to bless us with the spoil, but there are these other villages, these other cities that have been trashed by the Amalekites as well. Let's send them a bunch of stuff too. And so he very generously shared with them, which is a pretty honorable thing to do. And it says that he sent stuff in Hebron and to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to rove. Now, there were a couple of good things about this. For one thing, he's not greedy. So whenever you have a windfall, you can decide, am I going to spend more on me, or does this make it possible for me to help others? And the ironic thing is, helping others actually is the best thing you can do for you. Sitting on your winnings is never a healthy thing. It's never something that will ultimately give you what you want. But not only that, by him sharing with these other cities of Judah, after chapter 31, when the Philistines conquer and defeat Saul, now the nation's trying to put itself back together. David has been anointed as king, but guess who accepts him as king first? The tribes of Judah, because he blessed them. They saw the good that he was doing while Saul was off fighting against Philistines. But also David was from the tribe of Judah. He realized, hey, you're my people. And so that's kind of where he started his power base as he ultimately took over as the king of all of Israel. So him being generous was not just something that was totally against his self-interest, being generous and sharing is always in the self-interest of the person who is generous. Being greedy and hoarding what you have is always against the self-interest of anyone, which, you know, Jesus over and over again talked about that, you know, and he talked about the rich guy that just kept building bigger garages for all of his stuff. And he goes, your soul's required of you. Now what? What's that going to do for you? And so David seemed to understand this.
We'll share the rest of the story along with some great lessons that flow from it on the next Balanced Word with Dave Roth, a presentation of Pacific Hills Calvary Chapel and made possible through the support of our listeners.
Wake up my soul. Wake up early in the day. Wake up my hands. And